Okay. So, welcome. I am Kevin Griffin, and I am looking at the date on my computer. It is November 4th, 2025. Pretty soon, I have a feeling I'm not going to know what year it is. But gradual deterioration is a normal aspect of life. Gradual and then sudden. That's the change. That's one of those great descriptions of how change happens. It goes gradually and then suddenly, which is actually how the enlightenment sometimes is talked about, as the gradual path and sudden awakening or something like that. It's kind of a Zen thing. So good luck. I hope that your sudden awakening happens soon. But in the meantime, stick with the gradual. You can't go wrong. So we'll begin with 20 minutes of meditation, and I will give some instruction at the beginning of that, and then I will allow for some quiet time for all. Excuse me. Throat clearing. So, settling into your meditation posture, whatever is most supportive of your practice. The traditional instruction and suggestion is to sit upright. This isn't always practical for people, but if so, it generally supports the both clarity of mind and the ability to just relax. So we are trying to cultivate this combination of qualities of mindfulness, clear seeing, along with letting go of tension, stress. And so it helps to intentionally relax the body, let the shoulders relax, soften the belly, loosen the jaw. And overall, having a sense of ease, feeling tension draining from the body. And you can check through the body to see where there are areas of sensation. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There may be areas where you don't feel sensation, where it's very subtle. We're not trying to feel anything in particular. Just bring awareness to what is. What is the felt experience? And as we gradually settle, starting to direct the attention to the sensations of breath. You can feel the breath at the nostrils, where the touch of air is the sensation that we can feel. We can focus on the movement of the body, the belly or the chest rising, falling. Feel the breath on the inhalation, feel the breath on the exhalation. In this way, dividing the breath in two, we identify the particular sensations of in-breath and out-breath. This is a good beginning point for establishing mindfulness of the breath. Just to start to sense what it is we're trying to feel. And again, these are not special sensations. We're not trying to find something mystical in our breath, but simply be aware. Be aware of this subtle, ongoing experience, the body breathing. Before long, we will likely discover the movements of mind, realize that the attention doesn't necessarily stay with the breath. Mind wanders. Seeing this, observing this, knowing this is an essential part of our meditation. It allows us to see the habits of mind, the patterns of thought. as the attention becomes a bit more stabilized, start to see interactions of thought and feeling, of sensations and thoughts, of emotions triggered by thinking, or thinking triggered by emotions. All these patterns of causality reveal themselves. We become less caught in the grasping and aversion that arises through these movements of mind. Instead, simply observing, being present, allowing. Okay, I'm just going to grab a book. Excuse The book situation has gotten a bit out of control, I'm afraid. Files all over the place. Well, again, welcome, folks. Guess I wanted to mention a couple upcoming events this weekend. Actually, the next 2 weekends, I'm appearing, in person in Northern California. This weekend at Sacramento Buddhist Meditation Group. That's a day long on Saturday with Carson Koshin, who I believe is on here. I believe I saw him. There you are. Carson, maybe you can stick the link into the chat for people. I don't have it handy. Thanks. And then the following weekend, I'll be at Mountain Stream Meditation Center in Nevada City, Nevada City. Eleanor is helping out on that. Thank you, dear. That's a day long on Saturday, a recovery day long, and then on Sunday, a half day on loving kindness. So nice to be out and about and visiting with folks. Keeping me out of trouble, which is, good thing to do. Just as a topic this morning, I've been going through, I started going through Joseph Goldstein's mindfulness book as part of the teacher training and, training that I am training teachers. I know, hard to believe. But anyway, it's a fabulous book. If you haven't read this book, Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Awakening by Joseph Goldstein, I highly recommend it. It's on the four foundations of mindfulness, but it allows, because that sutta is so voluminous, it allows Joseph to really cover many of his great topics. And so the thing that sort of stood out for me, one of the things that stood out for me as I was starting to read through this was a section, if you happen to have the book, it's on page 22, called Continuity of Mindfulness. So I'll read a little bit of this because it's very practical guidance about meditation and about concentration in particular. He says, the strengthening of concentration comes about through the continuity of mindfulness. We can practice this continuity in two ways. The first way is
Evan,
cultivating.
can you turn the volume up or check your mic, please?
Sure.
Thanks.
Let's see. Microphone is on. That's my the, There are two controls on my microphone, one of which controls how loud it is for me. That's on the front, but the one that determines how loud it is for you is on the back. Can't go up much higher. Okay. Thank you. I can really hear myself well. I have to turn down earphones. Okay. All right, let me start again.
My volume is fine, as is a couple other people who have chimed
Okay.
in. So maybe
Yeah.
the
I'm
person
fine. I'm
can,
fine now. Thanks.
Okay. No worries. Everybody's in their own reality here, you know. This is the problem. Perception is conditioned. It is not absolute. The strengthening of concentration comes about through the continuity of mindfulness. It's actually, well, I'll go back, and because that sentence actually is something I wouldn't mind talking about. We can practice this continuity in two ways. The first way is cultivating a directed awareness on a single object. We practice keeping the mind steady on the breath, the movements of a step, a sound. So those are three different things that you could focus on: breath, walking, or sound. Those are just examples that you can pay attention to anything. The second way develops a more choiceless awareness. Each of these sentences we could spend a while on, but anyway, here we are cultivating one-pointedness of mind on changing objects. This is called momentary samadhi, as in quotes. Our practice is the skillful interweaving of these two approaches. We can focus on a single object when the mind is sluggish or distracted in order to develop internal joy and serenity. And then, when the mind is again collected, we can open to an undirected, choiceless mode of awareness. After some time, we get a very intuitive feel for which is appropriate at any given time. So, and that's just the first paragraph. It's one more paragraph, but it's more his personal practice. So, and at some point, I'm going to switch over to what Bhikkhu Anilayo says about some of this. One of the things I remember Joseph saying on retreats I've been with him is that every moment of mindfulness is a moment of concentration. It's a very kind of Joseph thing, but it's an interesting thought. Every moment of mindfulness is a moment of concentration. I think of concentration, I mean, I think of it differently from the way he does, I will say. This is, one version of it, which I think is very helpful and probably the most helpful way of thinking of it. But I think of concentration as he's saying, sustaining mindfulness, because truly being concentrated, we know, is not something that's just happening in quick bites. It's the difference to me between at least the experience of just being mindful for a moment and then sustaining that presence of mind. And there are distinct qualities that arise with that sustained focus. There's a calming of the body. The whole energetic system of the body settles, and there's all the science of this. The nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system. And then there are ongoing impacts, or I'm not sure I want to call them even secondary, but that as concentration is maintained, things more starts to happen. It's like there's a growing intensity around it, and some of that is captured in the term piti, which is this rapture, and then sukha, which is this happiness. But they sound emotional. I don't experience these things as ordinary emotions. They are more altered states, and indeed, the altered states of consciousness that come about through meditation are largely, if not entirely, the result of concentration. So to just say that to bring, mindfulness and concentration are connected, but there are distinct things that come through this really sustained concentration and evolving concentration. And I'm just pointing that out because I think it's useful to have a big picture. I don't think that that kind of sustained concentration, I don't think it's the most important thing. It has a role in our practice in terms of what most of us, I think, primarily seek through meditation. And maybe this is, claiming to read people's minds, but that most of those benefits come about through mindfulness and the insights that come through seeing the connect, sort of kind of making the connections that mindfulness makes for us. And I refer to these in the guided meditation today a bit, maybe a little too cryptically, but seeing how our thoughts trigger feelings and our feelings trigger thoughts, seeing patterns and biases and habits of mind, and being able to disidentify with them and observe them so that we're not in the constant reactive mode, but we are in a more responsive mode of seeing this is arising, what, and then bring intentionality to how I respond to that rather than just being triggered by things. That's what I feel is the kind of number one thing that most of us, sort of seek out of mindfulness meditation, because the result of that shift in perspective, of not getting caught so much in triggering experiences or events, is more serenity, is more clarity, and so that builds on itself. But it's in terms of just bringing that stress reduction, as we say, and a clarity that helps us to not just see things more clearly, but to make better choices moment by moment and day by day, because of that clarity. That's what I think is kind of more important than sustained concentration that I'm describing. Okay. But I actually ran into this term. I mean, the term he uses, choiceless awareness, is a familiar one. And so he says, the second way to develop concentration is more of a choiceless awareness. Here we are cultivating one-pointedness of mind on changing objects. So again, I think this is more of the common way that we teach and practice mindfulness, rather than I'm going to hold my attention on my breath in, out. It's more that, we see, oh, this is showing up and this is showing up, and I'm watching this, I'm watching that. I'm going to have to go back and look this up, though. The term choiceless awareness is not accepted by everybody as an actual like thing that the Buddha is teaching in a way. It seems to come later, and well, I shouldn't even. I've been reading. I started reading John Cage's book Silence, and he was interested in Zen, and but there was very little out there in those days. It was like Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki in the early 50s, and but I think he traced the term choiceless awareness to Aldous Huxley. I mean, I have to look that up. I'll get back to you on that anyway. Nonetheless, the reason I bring this point up, and it gets more clarified in this piece from Biko Analio, but the reason I bring this up is that I think we often have we can get a skewed idea of what we're supposed to do in meditation, what's supposed to happen. And that idea is, I think, arises because we just infer from the meditation instructions that some particular thing is supposed to happen and that we are supposed to do some particular thing. And that particular thing is we are supposed to just pay attention to our breath and we are supposed to not be thinking. And those are now the just paying attention to the breath, as Joseph says, is as an option, but it's not a supposed to. And not thinking is definitely not a supposed to. It's but when meditation teachers, as we do, say, start by paying attention to your breath, and when your mind wanders, bring your attention back to your breath. There's what's implied in that is that your mind isn't supposed to wander, that when it does, stop that. And get it back to your breath. You're doing it wrong. And again, it's not stated because it's not the instruction, but it's easy to interpret the instruction in that way. And my impression is that most people do interpret the instruction in that way at the beginning, which is why one of the most common questions for meditation teachers from beginners is, how do I stop thinking? So, in some sense, this is a failing of the way we teach meditation. But that failing, if I may defend the meditation teachers of the world, is because if you present choiceless awareness or something like that to someone who's never meditated, they're likely to get quite confused. It's not. The idea of just being present and letting things come and letting them go, as Suzuki Roshi says, is difficult to apply when you've got no experience of paying attention to your inner life, paying attention to your mind. And this group is largely made up of experienced meditators. And so I think you probably know a lot of what you understand what I'm talking about. And most of you, I think, also have the experience of being able to kind of sit and meditate in this less complicated, less structured way of like, just pay attention to the breath, and when the mind wanders, bring it back, of sitting in a more natural way, which I think, we're moving toward. Okay, well, let me move to Biko Analio, and this is from his book Mindfulness of Breathing. And it's a piece that I often read. I may have read it here in the last couple of weeks. I don't know. It's in the section Contemplation of the Body under a subsection called Modes of Attention. And it is page 41. Again, his book, Mindfulness of Breathing, Bhikkhu He says, and you'll recognize, I think, that he's talking about the same things, Joseph, two things that Joseph is talking about, the concentrating on the breath, or a more, Joseph calls choiceless awareness here. Anallio has a different term for it. Focused attention and peripheral awareness, considered on their own, make distinct contributions to our mental experience. Whereas focused attention picks out one aspect and thoroughly processes it, peripheral awareness involves a more receptive, open, and inclusive perspective that enables seeing things from a distance, as it were, and in their relationship to each other. Critical term. Come back to that. Due to its powerful thrust, focused attention can more easily fuel tendencies to fixate. Whenever I read that sentence, I'm surprised by the end of it. It's actually just a clause because he has a semicolon afterward. Due to its powerful thrust, focused attention can more easily fuel tendencies to fixate. At the same time, it also facilitates a more thorough analysis of the chosen object and provides more depth of information about it. Peripheral awareness is less prone to trigger fixation at the price of potentially remaining more superficial and imprecise. In the case of contemplating the breath, the ability to maintain a fairly stable awareness can be improved if the degree of focused attention we employ during the first two steps of the Anapanasati is combined with some degree of peripheral awareness. So he's saying the ability to maintain stable awareness can be improved if you use peripheral awareness. In other words, just focusing on the breath alone to the exclusion of everything else might at first allow us to dip in deep, but we also get more easily lost. This is because the tunnel view that results from such exclusive focus makes it difficult to notice when a diversion is about to lead to a displacement of attention. With some degree of peripheral awareness maintained, however, even though in the initial plunge is less deep, the advantage is that potential diversions can be noticed when they enter the edges of our field of awareness, and thus before they have successfully captivated our attention. The language of these things is clinical. So again, this is something that really can only be experienced, directly. The reading it, if you haven't experienced anything like this, there might be some confusion because it sounds sort of odd for him to say that, in a sense, you get it's more you get more easily distracted if you are concentrating on one thing. And my simple image for this is you've got the front door locked, but the back door is open. So you're just watching the front door so attentively that you're not noticing that somebody creeps in the back door. And so I just invite you to explore this and see if you can get some sense of this in your own practice. It's something I discovered in my practice before I read about it. And so that then reading this felt like an affirmation of something that I had sensed, which is that I'm gonna really focus and concentrate. And then I would find I was just completely gone. Whereas when I sit with whether it's choiceless awareness or what he calls peripheral awareness, I would just call a more open awareness. It's a sense of that, yeah, the mind isn't just locked in on something. There's a kind of flow going on, and they're sort of drifting off and coming back and drifting off and coming back, but it's not just gone. It's like And these states are so subtle and become so subtle that they're difficult to describe, and again can only be known through direct experience. But it feels more, I was going to say intentional, which is sort of odd again when we say just really concentrating on the breath. But what I mean by that is that I have more, even though I said choiceless awareness, I feel like I have more choice about where my mind is going. I'm kind of seeing it like get attracted to something and then, oh, okay, let that go. Getting attracted to something, let it go. And then I might get attracted to something and go, you know what? I think I'm just going to like really get into that. And that's, irresponsible meditating, I suppose. Or sometimes it is reflective meditation when it's like, oh, you're getting some insight and you decide you're going to intentionally think about something. But there was something here that I wanted to go back to. Well, I remember what it was, but I can't find the words. The advantage of oh, here it is. Sorry. Where he says, peripheral awareness involves a more receptive, open, and inclusive perspective that enables seeing things from a distance, as it were, and in their relationship to each other. And this is something I think I was already referring to this, but seeing things in relation to each other. Essentially, what that means is that you're seeing the law of karma. Law of karma is about cause and effect. And so, therefore, it is about the relationship of things to each other. And it is such a critical piece of our existence, of our development of wisdom. I haven't talked about addiction today, but just understanding addiction means understanding cause and effect. And for most of us, when we were active in our addiction, we were not seeing things in relationship to each other. We weren't seeing that the reason our lives were off the rails, for instance, was because of this behavior. We were blaming the wrong things. We were misunderstanding or misjudging causality. This is kind of the critical piece of human existence, human decision making, the flow, even politics is about causality. One person says you should allow, free public transportation. And another person says, oh no, if you do that, you'll wreck the economy or whatever. If you give people food, that'll be good. That'll have a healthier, community. No, if you give people food, then they'll become dependent. So that's just arguments about cause and effect. So with meditation, we start to see, and this is what the Four Noble Truths is about, is the Buddha is sitting and watching his mind, and he sees, what causes me suffering is when my mind gets attached to things and goes chasing after things. So that's about cause and effect. The Four Noble Truths are about cause and effect. And seeing that then gave him this vital piece of information. What I thought before I saw this was that when I went and chased after things that I wanted, it gave me the potential to be happy because once I got what I wanted, then I'd be happy, right? Sure, that's what makes sense. But by watching his mind and watching causality, realizes that's actually not true. This is this brilliant insight, right? That it doesn't, things don't really work like that. So this is why, well, we teach meditation and we talk about meditation as like learning to be concentrated, or even just about having more control over our attention, so that we're not, the dogs and up, the rabbit, or is it, what was it, squirrel, sorry, squirrel, that we aren't running like that. That's, our initial sense of what meditation is about, and it's how we're trained. But ultimately, what we want it to do is to give us the capacity to see things in their relationship to each other, and thus come to understand causality on a deeper level, and then operate with more wisdom in the world. So we got somewhere today, I will say. There's just a couple of minutes left. I talked longer than usual, but if anybody wants to comment or, oh, there you go. Bill, go ahead.
I want to jump in there quick. Give me
Sure.
the name of that, Joseph. I was kind of thumbing through the experience of insight and I didn't really see
Yeah,
anything.
no, the book is called Mindfulness.
Oh, it's just mindfulness. Okay.
Yeah, it's a relatively new book. It's published in 2013, relatively new for old people. I mean, the experience of insight was like 1976 or something. So,
Right.
yeah, 2013, and it's published by Sounds True, actually. So there's an audio
I'll
version
find
of it.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, the subtitle is A Practical Guide to Awakening. And he based this book, he tells you all this in the preface or in the opening. He based it on Bhikkhu Anālia's book on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So it's it, that's, but this is a much more accessible book than that. Yeah.
Well, I just feel like my practice has kind of evolved to that point anyway. I don't, but when I lead meditation in my group and everything like that, I at times feel like I'm kind of, a lot of people aren't as experienced. And so I'm going, get back to your breath, get back to your breath. And I want to kind of go different with them, kind of go in a different direction to some extent, not too much, but, in other words, saying if the thoughts arise, investigate it a little bit. Don't just, oh, I got to get back to my breath, So I don't know, it just made sense to me that what you were saying, so I appreciate it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
thanks, Bill. I mean, this is the conundrum of teaching meditation, that if people's attention isn't stabilized to some degree, and you say, well, investigate that, it winds up that they're very likely to just spend their whole time spacing out.
Going into a story, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's, but it's difficult when you have a drop-in group rather than like people that are all experienced meditators.
Oh, I get it.
You know, you don't want to be teaching something that they can't do, and so we wind up with a lot of beginner teaching to the beginner most of the time, and then the more experienced meditators are kind of like on their own.
I'm going to work on this a little bit, but anyway, well, good luck with your surgery, and so you don't have to depend on your daughter watching where that little white ball goes anymore. So that's,
Thanks.
yeah, good luck to you.
Yeah, I'm hoping that,
It'll be great.
I know, because
Everybody I know that's having surgery said it's incredible. So anyway,
I can only see my ball go about 100 yards now, and I'm like, where did that go?
I'm kind of getting there too, but I'm not quite.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks,
All
Kevin. I
right.
appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill. Nice to see you.
Yeah.
Hope this was helpful today. Really nice to have a Tuesday morning with you folks, as always. I will, we'll, we'll see what next week's, as we get older, I'm gonna go into the plural, first person. Parts of our bodies start getting replaced from the teeth to the hips to the knees to the eyes to the and others. I guess we can just, be grateful that modern science is making aging
Aging
less
easier.
aging easier. Okay, fine. I'll just leave it at that. Thank you. I won't try to get some complicated, but it's nonetheless a little daunting and great and freaky. One starts to feel like robo person. But
Luck.
thank you. All right, folks.
Thank
By
you,
the
Kevin.
way, I have all the previous up until last week, all the previous classes are up on YouTube and on my podcast feed. So if you're interested in going back, you're welcome to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.